Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Oh, you know, just hanging out. Hopefully you can't hear the parade noise in the background, because the Lakers won three straight games, so we got a parade going on in the downtown LA. It'll be over here any minute.
I'm part of that parade, man. I'm all in on the Lakers right now. I had so much fun staying up last night and watching them against the Suns.
Yeah, you've got your own float. I read your story this morning. You are jacked up.
I wasn't even supposed to write about the Lakers today, but I was just inspired last night. So, it happens. So for today's show, I just want to talk League Pass. I gave you an assignment to watch basketball this weekend and just take notes. And I think that's what we're going to do for these Monday shows, is just take notes on League Pass and just unload takes every Monday on what we see. So I feel like we should start with the Lakers right now.
It's hard to argue that they're not one of like the three biggest stories in the league, given, yeah. I mean, remember a month ago we were quoting the anonymous scout, the infamous anonymous scout from the SI magazine preview issue saying that there was no question the Lakers would be the worst team in the Western Conference. They were definitely going to have the worst defense. A lot of their young guys couldn't play,
right?
And Luke was a smart hire, but it was going to take a lot more than that.
Can I also add that I wasn't even sure Luke was that smart of a hire? Like, I think,
yeah,
coming into the
let's
year,
argue about that.
I was just worried that like he was coming from Golden State, where his claim to fame was essentially that he empowered those guys to do whatever they wanted. That team, that Warriors team, was as perfectly constructed a basketball team as you could have come up with. And so I just was, and before that, he hadn't done anything. Like, I think that was his first NBA job. So there was just a lot of hype coming into LA, to where I just wasn't sure what we were going to get. Like, he was being treated at like a savior and a no-brainer hire, and it was more of a gamble to me.
He's just one of those guys, though, that has that charmed aura about him.
Clearly.
Like, he constantly falls into success from, like, stop after stop after stop. Like, no matter where he's been, he just finds a way. And maybe it's, you know, growing up with the advantages of being Bill Walton's son, and so you're exposed to, you know, lots of really insanely awesome things at a young age. You know,
yeah,
you got the Grateful Dead rolling through to hang out. I mean, you know, that really opens your worldview and helps you relate to people, I think, in ways not a lot of guys can, but... I don't think this meteoric rise is like an accident. You know what I mean? I think his personality, his ability to connect with people is a big time plus in his factor. And you just look how hard these guys are playing. We haven't seen Nick Young play hard ever, have we? And this guy is going all out for the Lakers this season.
I would say that Nick Young, first of all, I'm glad that Nick Young is still around as the Lakers get fun, because he and Tarik Black are constant reminders of how dark the last 3 years were. So like, anytime they're on the court, that makes me appreciate every other Laker so much more. Like Brandon Ingram, D'Angelo Russell, Jordan Clarkson stepped his game up this year, and then Nick Young is a reminder of what it could be.
Yeah, no, but I really think that there's something to this idea with Walton, that he's got an ability to, he's like the millennial whisperer, I guess is the way to put it, right? Like, he's not doing the hokey things that these other coaches have tried to do, where it's like, oh, I'm going to wrap my, you know, pregame reports, or I'm going to recommend, you know, certain things for these young guys to try to do. I'm going to get them iPads so they can review tape, you know, like, he's not forcing it. It's just natural. Like, he can have a one-on-one conversation and D'Angelo Russell doesn't get bored and start Snapchatting 15 seconds into it. You know what I mean?
The millennial whisperer is a much less cooler nickname than the Zen Master. But yes, there's definitely something to what you're saying. And
Well, who would you rather be right now? Like, I mean,
no,
honestly,
look,
like,
man,
look at what Phil's doing. He's taking basketball back to like the 1960s at the worst possible time. He's squandering Porzingis. He's probably going to have to go through multiple more coaches until he figures out that his system is the problem. And then you compare that. I mean, it's a direct contrast. You look,
dude,
at what Luke's doing. Hey,
Luke Walton has been winning at life for like 15 years, dating back to the Lakers title teams, living in Manhattan Beach. Like, Luke Walton is doing a good job. He knows exactly what he's doing.
By the way, I thought he was the perfect hire. So I'm just going to like pat myself on the back. I mean, people can bring this audio tape back in a month when they are, you know, well below 500 and struggling to guard anyone. That's fine. I think from a personality standpoint, especially after Byron Scott, he was exactly what they needed. Like, even if Byron Scott wasn't in the picture ever and they just had like a normal replacement level coach, I think Luke Walton made sense as the Lakers coach. But going from Byron Scott to Luke Walton was like the perfect transformation. And it's probably going to save somebody like Jim Buss. That's probably going to buy him a little bit of time. That coaching change alone.
Yeah. No, it's been crazy how quickly he's clicked with those guys there, particularly D'Angelo Russell, because the way D'Angelo's game works right now, like, there are some nights when he just doesn't have it and they have to sort of lean on other people. But it seems like he and Walton are on the same wavelength, to where like Luke can go to some other guys. Sometimes it's Lou Williams, who I didn't even mention in the story today, but the fact that he's a productive player for them is crazy. But sometimes Luke Walton can lean on those guys more, whether it's Lou Williams, Nick Young, Jordan Clarkson, and it doesn't seem like D'Angelo Russell takes it personally, and that alone is like a huge step from last year.
Yeah, and I think some of that too is just Russell probably somewhere below the very confident exterior realizes that night to night he's still got a little work to do, right?
Yeah.
Like, he might not necessarily be that number one guy at this point of his life. He's still incredibly young. And so if you trust your coach, you trust that if you make a mistake, he's not going to like yank you and scream at you. You trust that you're going to get the opportunities when you're on. It's a lot easier to cede some of those touches, some of those shots, some of those opportunities to other guys, because you know it's going to come back to you, right? And I think that's why the Lakers are working. I mean, look how deep he's going into his bench. He's playing tons of guys. He's getting contributions from all these role players that you've mentioned, guys who would not even be in the rotation on lots of other teams with worse records, you know?
Yeah.
Put Nick Young into that category, are now playing productive basketball. Will it last? I think that's a fair question. But I think in terms of creating a new identity post-Kobe and post-Byron, I think he hit a home run right off the bat.
They're already so much further along than even Lakers believers would have expected. So you went to Warriors-Lakers on Friday night, right?
Yeah, I did. And actually, it was great because it was a perfect contrast. Remember, I kind of gave you my report from the first game where it was like all the fans showed up in Kobe jerseys and they didn't totally know what to expect and who are these guys in the pregame video.
Uh-huh.
Well, needless to say, the Lakers home crowd has done its homework. It knows these guys inside and out now, and they are so stoked as soon as like the tip-off starts. I mean, they're so ready to go. I mean, the celebrities are back courtside. You know, Denzel's just got a smile on his face for, you know, basically 3 straight hours watching the games.
Oh, yeah. I bet there were a ton of celebrities there.
Yeah. The buzz is just really, really back. And I think, you know, style of play wise, that helps too, right? Like, you could be a good team and be boring and not sell tickets, but you play. I mean, it's not like it's showtime, you know, but they're up and down. They're turning, you know, a guy like Julius Randle completely loose.
Yeah.
And when the Warriors kind of came out there and played with what, 50% effort or, you know, 60, 70% yeah, effort?
That was like a classic hungover in LA game.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help that Drake was on the team plane the night before.
Can I ask you something? Like, I was thinking through that. So they probably traveled Thursday night, right?
Yes.
So they get in at like 1 a.m., 2 a.m. local. So I was thinking through this and I was like, I mean, clearly watching the game, they're all hungover and out of it. But I'm wondering, like, there aren't that many places in LA that are open until, like, you can party at until 5 a.m.
Well, not that you and I could party at. Yeah. I think you could.
Yeah. No, I mean, clearly there's just like an Illuminati version of LA, probably just at Drake's house. That's probably where it all went down. But, like, you have to want it to go out that late, given their circumstances.
Yeah, something tells me they're going to be able to get into a little trouble if they wanted to at 3 a.m.
Yeah, exactly.
In LA. I don't think it's going to be like a last call situation where they just like slowly trudge back to their hotel rooms disappointed. I think they're going to be okay.
Well, that was my nerdy thought process on Friday night. Was like, huh, I wonder, like, the mechanics of going out have got to be pretty interesting. But yeah, the Lakers came out and just kind of kicked their ass.
Yeah, I think the mechanics of going out were you land off the private plane with Drake. There's a row of Uber XL Blacks, whatever the fancy Ubers are, that drive you to a funhouse where every single one of your greatest desires could be fulfilled within about 15 minutes of getting off the plane. I think that's really how the mechanics go.
And can I just tell you that Luke Walton has been living that life for like 15 years. So shout out to him.
What do you know? The Lakers are back.
And he got the win Friday night.
here's my big takeaway on the Warriors, though, from that game, besides the, you know, lackadaisical effort and so forth, is that the vibe in the locker room is different. Like, I think that we are now post-peak Warriors hype. Even though everyone expected more scrutiny this year with Durant and so forth, I think last year during that run to 73, the frenzy around it, I mean, the rock star vibe that Steph had, I'm not going to say that Steph is sort of like back to being a normal person, because that obviously is not ever going to happen. But just even the number of people who are covering the game afterwards, the number of like international media members with, you know, tears running down their eyes when they see Steph Curry. I mean,
right.
there's just a little bit of a step backwards, I think, from last year's the peak in the hysteria. I don't know if it's because they lost the title. I don't know if it's because they're not the brand newest thing anymore. I don't know if it's because they just happened to lose that game against the Lakers, and so the Lakers were the story that night. It just wasn't the same level of like completely overwhelming, like awkward, you know, fan interaction in those media environments. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because that's certainly how it's felt for me. Like, I had so much fun watching the Warriors last year. Every game was kind of appointment TV, and it just doesn't feel that way right now. Like, I'm legitimately more excited to stay up and watch D'Angelo Russell and Julius Randle than I am to watch Steph Curry, which is, it's a strange place to be. And I think part of it is probably because so much of their success is now a foregone conclusion. So I don't really care. Like we bring up the Warriors, and in my head, I'm like, I don't have more Warriors opinions. Like, I'm all set. You know what I mean?
Well, I think part of it too is that Steph hasn't really been Steph, you know, and maybe that's acclimating to playing alongside KD. Maybe it's them trying to get KD comfortable, you know, in year one, and trying to structure things around him. But the number of magical moments per game that we've seen from Steph is way down from last year, no question about it. The game on Friday happened to snap his 157 game streak with at least one three-pointer.
That was a Golliver stat late Friday night. Loved it.
Oh yeah. No, I was going real deep cut on that. Here's some stats for you. So over the course of that streak, he averaged more than four made threes per game for 157 games. And he shot 45.2% on three-pointers for the entire streak, which lasted nearly 2 years.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Like, it's scary to think that if anyone would ever be able to challenge that. But at the same time, you know, that's the way the game's going. So maybe someone will come along and kind of like push that. But God, that he was red hot for 2 years in a row.
Yeah, no, awesome. I think there's no question that we're going to look back on this stretch and be baffled that it was real. Because I don't think that people are going to be able to, I don't think that that's going to become like a baseline where everybody's shooting 45% from three. I think Steph is going to be a historic anomaly for the next 15 to 20 years.
Here's my short-term question for you on that very point, though. It's like, are we also in this era where like Steph is no longer going to be as great as Steph was last year? Like, is the situation changed enough where now we're only going to get 90% or 95% of Steph? And if so, that's kind of sad, right? And maybe that takes away some of the magic from this team.
Yeah, I'm not worried. And again, I think most of the Warriors' storylines and narratives will sort themselves out like 6 months from now, once it's time for the playoffs. I think we should all just sort of chill on the Warriors. I do have one slightly different question for you. I saw a trade rumor today, or not a trade rumor, but it was a tweet, and someone suggested that the Warriors would be better off trading Klay Thompson for Victor Oladipo, and that both teams in that scenario would be much better off. Now, first of all, that is a insane opinion. But second of all, could you imagine how much fun that would be to have Klay cast off by the Warriors and out for revenge with Russ?
Yeah, who tweeted this?
I don't know. I'm not going to put anybody on blast. I just saw it out of nowhere, like, at like 11 a.m. this morning.
Like, was this like deplorable Sooner 26 or something?
I don't know. Well, look, it was crazy enough so that I actually felt bad tweeting it. I was too embarrassed for that person to share it, but nothing would make me happier than Klay somehow getting kicked out of the Warriors and then going after them with Russ.
Well, I'm really glad to know that the standard for tweeting is higher than your standard for throwing crap at me on this podcast.
That's, oh, absolutely. Are you kidding me?
That's really good for my self-esteem.
Yeah.
I don't see that trade happening. Obviously, trading an amazing all-star player for a guy who's still trying to find his way in the league would not be a good move for Golden State.
Yeah.
But here's another thing about that game on Friday. And it's been a trend for Clay, I think, this whole season, is this dude is missing wide open shot after wide open shot. And when the ball's coming off of his hand, it doesn't even seem like it's going to go in. I mean, there used to be this feeling last year for months in a row where every shot he took, no matter how ridiculous and contested and hard it was just going to drop. And there were so many times in that Lakers game where it felt like he was pulling up and for whatever reason, it just wasn't going to go in. Like, it you know, just had that sense to it. I don't see any obvious like hitch in his motion or whatever, but he just didn't seem like he was shooting with that same kind of like blank confidence. In other words, where he's like, you know, not even really thinking about it. He's just doing it. It kind of seems like he's overthinking and pressing a little bit. So hopefully he settles in and plays better, because, you know, both he and Steph simultaneously just missing shot after shot after shot against the Lakers was hard to watch, kind of, you know?
Yeah. You know how every year or after every Olympic cycle, there's like a handful of guys who come back to the league and everyone's like, yeah, you know, I think his time with Team USA like really made a big difference. He's really taken a step forward. No one is saying that about Klay Thompson this year.
Yeah, no doubt. And quite the opposite. I mean, people are already saying, hey, is he tired? Is he overworked? And so forth.
I think, but the flip side of that, and this is probably the last thing we need to say about the Warriors, is that like, I don't care, because I know that whatever's going on with Klay will work itself out. Like, he's one of the best shooters of all time. So it's hard for me to even like think too much about this team right now. I think we should revisit them in January and then see where they are. But this is not about the Warriors. This is a podcast about the Lakers and about League Pass. So I want to talk about the Lakers-Suns last night. Did you watch that?
I caught a little bit of it. I was working on something, so I didn't get to do the full deep dive, but I'd love to hear your breakdown, because you were just texting me random letters that didn't even look like English.
I was texting you about Tarik Black. There was one play, I think it was like the third quarter, where Tarik Black tried to dunk on four people. Most people listening to this podcast probably don't even know who Tarik Black is. He's like a 6'8 center who's somehow stuck with the Lakers the last few years, and That was a moment where I was like, this is why I watch. And then the other thing, I really like this Suns team as a League Pass standby, because TJ Warren is one of the more creative scorers in the league. He's got like a really unorthodox game. And then what made last night fun is that like the Lakers, who are, I guess, a good team now, were blowing the Suns off the court. And then Devin Booker just got hot and started to make it like a real close game down the stretch.
Yeah, I mean, the Suns played a great League Pass game against the Blazers last week too, where Bledsoe hits the crazy super low percentage three-pointer to win it as like a walk-off in overtime. And
yeah,
there was, you know, multiple situations there with the Suns where like they looked like they were ready to blow it, and they kind of did, but then they managed not to. So they're just kind of a chaos team.
Right. They're not a lot of defense, a lot of shooters, a lot of mouths to feed on that roster. And it's definitely doesn't inspire a lot of confidence like in the long-term plan for that group of players. But they're fun to watch every night.
Yeah, I feel you. Well, so from the Lakers, what was your big takeaway, I guess, from – was there a specific player, or was it – you know, just general happiness? I mean, I saw you kind of highlighted Randall a little bit in your piece.
Yeah, Randall is the key for them, because I think if his progress is real, because right now he's able to play in space a decent amount and space the floor a little bit. And then he's also like, he's hitting the boards. He basically does everything but shoot. And if he can add a little bit of a jumper and continue to do everything else that he's been doing through the first few weeks, like Luke Walton was playing him as a small ball five last night. And long term, that lineup could get really scary if Julius Randle's a small ball five, Brandon Ingram is the four, and then you got Clarkson and Russell in the backcourt. They basically only need a fifth starter at that point, and they are really good. Plus, Larry Nance Jr. is his own, like, I'm reluctant to get too excited about Larry Nance Jr., but every time I watch him, he's impressive.
The Lakers fans love him. And like,
I know. He's like a cult hero.
He has dunked the other night where he just like palmed the guy's head with his left hand as he was like thrashing a dunk through the rim with his right hand. Yeah, I mean, that was something else. You know, Randall as a small ball five, I still have my hesitations in buying into that's going to work defensively. But I do think he looks a lot more comfortable this season. I mean, he really looked almost, you know, unhelpful last year under Byron Scott. And I think it's another case where like a guy like him can easily overthink too much, right? Like he can basically think his way into being unproductive and unhelpful. And, you know, this season it looks like, you know, the reins are off. There's full trust there. He's making, I think, better decisions when he does push the ball up the court a little bit. I think he's more consistently imposing his physical gifts. I mean, when you have that unique combination that he does of, you know, speed at his position and power and, you know, footwork and kind of cuts and so forth, you have to be in the open court to kind of show all that stuff off. Otherwise, it's not really going to work.
100%.
They're doing a nice job of getting into the open court and really committing to that pace. So, you know, from that standpoint, he's been night and day. And there's been like three different games this year where I was like, wow, that's the best I've ever seen Julius Randle play. And then I'm like, wait a minute, was it better than last week?
Yeah.
So like, I don't know. I think I'm not saying I'm completely converted on him, but if everyone continues to go small around the league, it becomes easier and easier to use him as a five. And then you can just have this crazy lineup that just runs the ball down your throat and really just, you know, tries to spread you out a little bit and does a pretty good job of making up for his lack of shooting.
Yeah, I'm not totally sold on him either, but put it this way, like if he can be the version of the player that you just described and the league starts to evolve that way, I think if he continues to progress, it puts the Lakers in a whole different category. Like coming into the year, we expected them to be sort of a fun, chaotic young team, and if Randall is for real, then they're in the category with the Wolves where you're like, check back in 3 years, this team is going to be terrifying.
Okay, so here's my philosophical question for you, okay?
Uh-huh.
You're always like coming to the defense of guys like Jahlil Okafor for their skill and how you're kind of bemoaning the fact that the league is changing and kind of making it harder for these guys to play big minutes and so forth, right?
Yeah, well, that's out one side of my mouth. And then out the other side of my mouth, I'm trashing Jahlil Okafor and Enes Kanter, but it's all good.
Well, yeah. So I'm saying, why don't you listen to that other side of your mouth more? Because if the future is everyone's playing centers like Julius Randle, isn't that better for everyone? Don't we all win as an audience? Doesn't basketball win? Doesn't, you know, the television partners win for higher ratings?
Well, yes.
Isn't that just a better game?
Look, man, I'm allowed to have complicated emotions, okay? I'm pro at, like, basketball today is so much more fun than it was 15 years ago. But at the same time, I do feel bad for a dude like Kenneth Faried, who there's just not a whole lot of use for him anymore. So it's bittersweet what's happening around the league. But it's for the best. I have one more Lakers question for you.
Okay, so that just sounded like real lip service, by the way. I'm not sure anyone's buying your sympathy.
I'm not convincing anyone. So Devin Booker went off for, I think he had 39. He had 38 or 39 points last night. Would you rather have Devin Booker or D'Angelo Russell running the Lakers for the next 10 years?
Oh, man. Well, I'm sure the Lakers fans have already got the hashtag going that Booker's a future Laker. I don't know if that's true, but there's a 97% chance that that's true because they love trying to to poach other people's young talent. That's tough. I might take Booker, but that's really close.
He's so good. And it's funny because I was watching last night and there are a lot of times when he looks too small because he's skinny, he's not that tall, and he has to be kind of crafty to get his shot off. So early in the third quarter, I was watching him thinking, like, I don't know if I see it with Devin Booker because he has trouble getting open looks. Let's put it that way. And then from there, he just exploded and hits literally everything. And it's the closest thing there is to Steph, where like you're just not sure how he's doing it. And it's like, this dude is a wizard because he can get just a tiny bit of space and then hit everything.
Yeah, he's going through a nice week. I mean, he started pretty slow in that game. I don't know if you saw the game against the Pelicans that went to OT. I mean, he had a shot that basically hit the top of the backboard and went in. So you know you have real touch when you're shooting shots over the backboard. It's hit the top of the backboard and it's dropping swish. it's tricky. I just think maybe it's a little bit easier to build around a Devin Booker than it is a Russell. But, you know, I'm not sure that we've seen anything close to Russell's best work yet either. You know, like, well, I feel like people expect him to be further along. I don't know. Maybe it's just the draft position of why there's like higher expectations for him. But, you know, when I look at Booker's game, like, he's just very, very transferable. I think you could put him on basically every team and really get, you know, a lot from him. I mean, he could be, if you already had ball handlers, I think he could shift down into like a complementary role really well and be really good at it. I think if you don't have any ball handlers, he could do a lot more of that for you.
Yeah.
Still got a long ways to go defensively, obviously. But with Russell, I think he sort of has to be more or less the guy, you know?
Well, that's the thing. Russell's passing is pretty crazy when he's looking to distribute. And I also think that he's going to be a lot more physical than Devin Booker long term, because he's going to get stronger and learn how to use his body. And he's already so good at getting into the lane that it really is a toss up. And I, in my piece today, I wrote that, like, there's a chance that this turns into like a wild rivalry over the next 10 years because they're both so, so good.
I mean, that's definitely possible. I mean, when you look at the Pacific, you know, there's definitely going to be a change in the guard here fairly soon, right? I mean, I think the Clippers, there's a timetable on them. And then the Lakers are clearly making a play for, like, we're going to have a long window with the, you know, with the core that they've got, because we're not even mentioning Ingram. And you could argue that Ingram's a better long-term piece than either of those two guys that you're mentioning, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So
I think you're in a situation, yeah, where, you know, 2-3 years from now, the Lakers could be right back on top of the conference. I mean, what the most interesting part about this Lakers hot start, and assuming that they can really kind of build some momentum from this and kind of, you know, not fizzle and put up a respectable win total and so forth, is that what does that mean for free agency next summer? You know, like, are they actually going to be in position to go after real players for the first time in years? Because, like, they've just been the strikeout king in meetings year after year after year. I mean, are they going to be able to make noise next summer? I think I've always kind of written them off these last couple of years and mocked who they've even targeted, guys like Mozgov on day one, you know, I mean, things like that. But if you start to get that positive buzz, other people around the league can see it. These guys are now established contributors. Doesn't it become a lot easier to pitch people?
It would be pretty, I mean, in a year and a half, Paul George is a free agent. He's from, I think he's from Palmdale, California, basically L.A., you know, so,
well, people from LA would say that Palmdale is not basically LA, but, well, everyone else would say
right.
<that.
laughs> he's from that part of the country, and that's sitting there as like the nuclear option. I hope, though, that I just don't want them to make any like rash decisions. It's always a risk. Now that things are rolling, I don't want them to think, oh my god, let's trade for Rudy Gay and push for the 8th seed. Like, chill, just enjoy this core for a little while.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. But I guess the comparison is sort of like they're the Celtics a couple of years ago, right? Where you're eventually building up to the point where you can nab a guy like Al Horford as an unrestricted free agent. And, you know, he was like, what, a top five guy on last summer's market?
Yeah,
is that
but I
unreasonable
think,
for the Lakers to do that either next summer or the following summer? I don't think so.
No, definitely not. But I think the key with the Celtics is they said, look, we're not going to gut the team that we have and the assets, like the Nets picks and everything else. We're not going to trade those guys for a B-plus star who doesn't really change our bottom line. So they weren't willing to gut the team for Jimmy Butler. They probably wouldn't do it for Paul George, although I could see them dealing a Brooklyn pick this spring. But that's the thing, that I think this Lakers core is already progressing to the point where, like, everybody sort of sees the writing on the wall and isn't going to screw with it. But this summer, I would have been on guard if I were a Lakers fan, being like, look, please just don't trade one of these three or four guys and just let it mature on its own and see what we have in 2 years.
Yeah, I think that once you're on the back on the correct side of the expectations game, you know, like, once you're now playing with house money, and I think they already are doing that, you know, the pressure to do the kind of quick strike move lessens considerably, right? Like, you know, don't you start to realize, like, oh, well, we actually have something to, you know, we have something good going here. Let's just ride this out and see where it goes. No one's going to be mad at us for, you know, being the 9th seed or even the 11th seed or the 12th seed, because it's been more entertaining. And Luke kind of projects things going the right direction, too. So I'm not sure I see them doing those kinds of nightmare scenarios that you're mentioning.
Well, look, man, I've successfully steered the conversation to 30 minutes on the baby Lakers, so my work here is done. Let's look around the league a little bit, though. League Pass. You were texting me during Kings Raptors. What'd you see during that game?
Well, you told me you were going to write a piece on DeMar DeRozan. What happened to that one?
I honestly was until I watched the Lakers, and I was like, you know what? I don't have the energy to spend a few hours thinking through the Raptors. Let me just write about this Lakers team. So that was more about the Lakers and less about DeRozan.
I would say that their loss to the Kings was arguably the worst loss that anyone's had all season long. I mean, it's in the discussion.
The Warriors opening night loss was the worst loss anyone's had all season.
No. Because that was to a good team. So let's just set the stakes here. Last week, we'd mentioned how Sacramento likely would fall off during their first road trip, correct?
Well, we sort of mentioned that. I also was like, I think I might like this Kings team. And then I think we both sort of couched it in warnings about this upcoming road trip.
Well, let's just say here's how it played out. First game, double-digit loss to Atlanta. Second game, a loss to Miami in which Cousins gets 6 fouls in the fourth quarter. Third game.
I still can't believe that really happened.
No, it did really happen. It was ridiculous. Third game, they lose to Orlando, which I didn't even know was possible these days. They actually give up 102 to Orlando, which is like giving up 160 to a normal team. Fourth game, they go to Milwaukee, who's also been kind of shaky, and they just get completely blown out by 20+. And so fifth game, they're going from Milwaukee to Toronto on a dreaded back-to-back. And so that just screams 0-5 trip, players-only meeting, Cousins cusses somebody out.
It was also 5 games in 7 nights, which I didn't even think could happen anymore.
Nightmare trip.
I thought that was like phased out of the NBA after a true hoop series.
Yeah, no kidding. So everything is pointing to Raptors, you know, kind of take advantage of a strong home crowd, take advantage of these schedule conditions, you know, walk all over the Kings and continue beating their chests about how amazing they are and how great DeRozan is and how he's the next Jordan and Wilt Chamberlain and so forth.
Right, right.
Needless to say, it did not play out that way. Cousins just ate them alive. Surprise, surprise, DeRozan's field goal percentage is now headed back towards the mean. Kyle Lowry continues to struggle with his shot, as I mentioned last week, and they look like they have this big hole in the middle once they don't have Valanciunas. And I think, you know, he was obviously the big X factor kind of why the game played out as it did, because when you've got somebody like Cousins, you just need somebody to bang with them, and trying to throw Jakob Poeltl and Bebe Nguera into that mix is kind of a recipe for disaster. But that's one of the big concerns here with the Raptors, right? Like, they lose Biombo and they didn't have anyone experience to kind of back up behind Valanciunas in case he goes down, and he's had injury issues in the past too. So I mean, that looked like a pretty critical weakness. And then you look at Toronto's schedule, and they've had, you know, a lot of pretty weak games so far in their 4 wins, whether it's, you know, Denver and Detroit without Reggie Jackson. So you kind of have to wonder, you know, was this a warning sign? And now Toronto's got to go on the road a little bit too. So I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of excitement from north of the border here in the first week. And I like watching that game. It was like, ooh, like,
look,
you know,
look, I'm going to let you, do you like how I cleared out there and let you beat your chest about, being right about DeRozan?
I'm not beating my chest. I'm not even saying I'm right about him. I'm just saying that was, I'd be a little scared. I mean, you drop a home game, you only scored 91 points against the Sacramento Kings, who just gave up 100+ to the Orlando Magic. You wouldn't be a little bit concerned about that?
I don't know. I think we need to remember that the regular season is essentially meaningless, and there's going to be rough Sunday afternoon games, and, you know, things happen. My biggest takeaway was Jakob Poeltl. I don't know what Boogie was doing to Jakob Poeltl would make me retire. So I hope that he's a stronger person than I am, but I would give up after that. The other thing, my other takeaway from that game was Rudy Gay is going to trick some team into giving him like $60 million over 3 years this summer, and it's going to be great.
Doesn't he have Pelicans max contract written all over him?
Yeah, 60 is low, actually. He's going to get like 120. And it's based solely, like, somebody is going to have watched the first 3 weeks of the Sacramento Kings and be like, you know what? I'm a believer in Rudy Gay. And because I guarantee you he's going to tail off from here. But he's playing really well right now. I mean, he's hitting shots, he's getting rebounds, and is like a legit second option next to Boogie. Of course, caveat, the Kings got their ass kicked on this road trip until the Raptors, but he's definitely playing well enough to trick someone around the league.
Well, yeah, it starts with the worst guys, the worst GMs. You know, I mean, that's really where you want to start the conversation when you play Massmaker.
In Washington, D.C., I am definitely on guard for a Rudy Gay midseason trade.
Oh, that'd be perfect. Yeah, you guys would love that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd really help the consistency on a night-to-night basis. Oh, by the way, that's one of my takeaways, too, from that same Saturday night slate of games, or maybe it was Friday. Whenever the Wizards played the Hawks, I thought the Wizards should have just had to forfeit that game once they gave a wide open three in the corner to Kyle Korver up in the last minute. Like, that is just one of those things that's just completely unforgivable, and they won the game anyways, and it's their only win of the season. But I think we should actually take that back from Washington and say, no, you can't have it. You violated basketball rules.
No, we really need the win. I recorded a second podcast on Friday after I talked to you, and it was just talking through the Wizards and where they are. And it might have been like the darkest pod I've ever been a part of. So we needed that win however we could get it. I'm glad. Did the Korver look go down?
Oh, yeah. No, it went down. And I mean, it didn't. Like, there was a situation where it wasn't like a game winner. You know, it didn't really threaten things. But it was just one of those.
Well,
you know,
no,
and the guys were looking around at each other like, how do we give this up? You know, and just confusion. And it's like, guys, this is below the minimum standard of competence for an NBA game.
I went into a restaurant during that game, and the Wizards were up double digits going into the fourth quarter, and then somehow it was a one possession game at the end. So I'm glad that they did their very best to make it interesting for everyone around the country, and I'm glad that we got lucky at the end. So, you know, then the next night they lost to Orlando, which is Kings level bad.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Well, here's what I would be worried about if I were you. I'm looking at this Eastern Conference sort of like kind of standings race, and it really hasn't separated. But if you just look at it right now, the other teams that are around the Wizards near the bottom all feel like teams that have really not a great shot at the playoffs. You know, I mean, there's the Heat, the Knicks, the Nets, the Sixers. So do we just think the Wizards are like graced with some ability, just magic skills, that they're going to break out of that pack, or are they ready to be doomed?
Look, I'm not ready to write the season off yet. However, this week will be big. The Wizards have Houston tonight. Houston, not a good team. Should beat them, but we'll see. Celtics.
We'll definitely lose to Houston.
The Celtics struggling. Cavs Friday, and I think they've got...
That's a loss.
I forget who they play. Basically, they need to come through this stretch like one or two games below 500, and their ninth game is the Sixers. So if they can get to like 3-5 or 4-4 by the time they play the Sixers, everything will be fine, and they'll be a good bottom half of the East playoff team. But I'm not holding out hope.
Realistically, they'll be 2-7, and Philly will take their first win off of them, won't they?
Yeah. Realistically, we talked before the season, and I was like, look, this team is either going 50-32 or 30-52. Right now, it's looking a lot more like 30-52, which is fine because they'll get a lottery pick and trade it for Boogie. That's what I tell myself.
Boom. Well, that's a good coping mechanism. All right. Hey, did you see the Paul George incident?
I saw it via your Twitter.
Well, it was strange. Like, they were up big, like in full control of a game. He gets called for a foul. The ball's just kind of like bouncing around on the baseline. He tries to kick it. I guess he does kick it, but I think his plan was to kick it off to Stanchion and have it like come back to him, but he completely missed the Stanchion, mm-hmm. and the ball just drills this woman straight in the face. And like, he didn't kick it that hard, but like hard enough where she's like, you know, and it was also hard enough for him to realize like, whoa. And he like immediately walked over and hugged her and apologized. Like, it was, he tried his best.
Yeah.
But the situation sort of demanded the referees just eject him straight away. And I was like, this doesn't seem like it should be happening to a guy with Paul George's stature. And if the situation was going well for them and everybody was kind of like happy in Indiana and they were off to a good start, like, does that incident take place? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were up 20 points in that game, right? Like,
that's what I'm saying. Like, they were in total control. They were in total control. There was not really any reason to be that mad.
So I'm not going to read a whole lot into it, except that seeing the difference between what happened in real life once I saw your video and the way it was being described on Twitter, because it, like Twitter, it said Paul George kicks ball into stands and then goes into stands. And I was like, oh my God, like, is this Malice at the Palace part two? Like, what happened here? But
Steven Jackson time.
Everyone neglected to add that he went into the stands to apologize to the woman and he kicked the ball into the stands by mistake. So I don't know. I think in David Stern's NBA, he still would be suspended for like double digit games for this. But I think Silver, I'm pretty sure he's in the clear.
I think he's going to have to get fined. But I don't think it's like a $15,000 fine. I mean, his explanation was great. He's like, my soccer skills aren't as good as I thought they were, which that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of cleaned it up after the fact, but still it's like, man, I don't know. You just kind of wonder in a situation like that, that was completely unnecessary. Where does that instinct come from? Maybe he's just frustrated because, you know, he's kind of been in grief towards the officials for the last couple of years. Like, he's always kind of taking shots at the referees and the stripes, and he's always kind of throwing things out like that. He feels like he doesn't get enough calls that he deserves. And he's trying to kind of work the officials in kind of a Chris Paul type of way, but it backfired here for sure.
Yeah, man. I mean, what you're saying is he needs the Lakers. He needs a change of scenery. I hear you, and I agree. And that last topic here, Bucks Mavericks last night. Did you watch any of that game?
Come on. No.
Really? Not even a little bit?
No, Mark Cuban revoked my league pass subscription.
Topical. So what do you think of the Cuban stuff?
I mean, I just think that that's the ultimate petty display from NBA teams. And like, over the years, I've kind of had to deal with similar, you know, things. Like, it gets threatened, or hey, if you do this again, we're going to have to look at it or whatever. And I just think it should be something that's just never a question. You know,
it should never get to that. When have you ever gotten warned by a team?
Yeah, I don't want to go into specifics about it because it's not really fair to the people involved. But
okay. Yeah,
I mean, there are situations where, like, if you write something that's critical, or if there's stuff that you're tweeting about or whatever, and the team feels like it's over the line or whatever, they might come at you and say, hey, no, not like necessarily directly threatening it, or in some cases directly threatening it, but they have the right to issue these credentials, right? And so it's usually not a quid pro quo situation where, like, you write that someone, you know, is a horrible player and needs to be traded, but sometimes there, you know, you push the wrong button and people get frustrated and upset about it, and that becomes an issue. Usually you can kind of, cooler heads will almost always prevail in these situations, right? Like,
yeah,
my guess is he got particularly upset about ESPN's coverage for whatever reason. And so he kind of wanted to take his ball and go home, right? And usually there's a way to kind of compromise, especially with the league office's help, to kind of like get things back on track, right? So I'm hoping that, you know, common sense will prevail here, as they usually do in credential situations. But this is one avenue where I just wish it was never an issue. I wish that either the NBA had some role as sort of an official overseer of these situations that could kind of prevent these minor conflicts, or in this case, a pretty major conflict between Dallas and the ESPN from taking place, because it doesn't serve anyone. It definitely does not serve the fans. It certainly doesn't serve the media. It doesn't serve the NBA's league interests. And it's a bad look for the team too. So it's just bad all around. There needs to be better checks and balances here.
It's definitely never a good look when the two best analogies for your behavior are Donald Trump and Dana White of the UFC. So that alone should give Mark Cuban pause. Not that it did, but yeah, my reaction to all that was basically like, this will resolve itself in 48 hours and I'm not going to pay attention to it until it does. I will say that, like what you said, the NBA is so good. I've never had a problem where people will talk about credentials, and I've certainly been written my fair share of negative whiz stuff over the years, but the NBA is the best league of any sport at dealing with the media in terms of the way they accommodate people from all kinds of different publications. So I was surprised. I think this would be a bigger deal if it were a different owner than Cuban. Like, people have been talking about this being a slippery slope, but I honestly just kind of look at it like, Cuban has always been crazy. No one really takes him that seriously. And if it were a different team denying credentials, then the outrage would be more justified. And in this case, I think it's everyone's like, whatever, this is going to resolve itself when Cuban calms down and he gets a stern email from Adam Silver.
Yeah, I take it back. There always usually is one winner from these situations, and it's the writers who wind up getting barred and then let back in because everybody looks at them and they remember, Steiny wait a minute, Moe. These guys are awesome. And Mark Stein's an unbelievable reporter. Everybody knows that. And Tim McMahon's a really, really good reporter too, who goes toe-to-toe with coaches in press conferences, who, you know, breaks his fair share of news, who's got a really unique kind of incisive view on things around the league. And so, I mean, as long as they get back in the door eventually, this could kind of be a nice little boost in profile for both those guys, and they deserve it. And I would guess if you had truth serum from Mark Cuban, he realizes that those are the two guys very near the top of the totem pole, if not at the top of the totem pole, of guys covering his team, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's a personal situation towards them.
Yeah. If anything, it's even crazier to try and ban those two guys. Like, I don't think Mark Stein will have a problem getting into any NBA arena in the league. Can I give you two notes from the actual game?
Oh, yeah, please. This is the barn burner, the Harrison Barnes burner.
The Harrison Barnes burner. Yeah, absolutely. Barnes had, I think, 32 last night and was great for them down the stretch. Of course, down the stretch, I looked up and it was 72-72. And I thought it was the third quarter, but it was actually the fourth quarter. So that's what kind of night it was in Dallas. My two takeaways, though, are that the Bucks are almost a good team. Like, they are much closer than I expected them to be to being, like, playoff level in the East. But the one issue is that they haven't figured out a way to use Giannis and Jabari together, because Jabari is really good. But then when Giannis is initiating things, like, Jabari spends probably more than 50% of his possessions just standing in the corner.
Yeah, and I mean, the stats are hilarious. I mean, I'm sure you saw that tweet going around where he's like, you know, Giannis is leading them in like every single category that they measure, like points, rebounds, assists, and on and on. And yeah, he's definitely doing a lot. And there's a limit to, you know, at what point does that kind of harm other guys? And it's one thing if it's Westbrook in Oklahoma City and Kyle Singler and Roberson are standing around.
Yeah.
It's another thing if it's Jabari Parker and, you know, you're stuck on 70 points in the fourth quarter and that's what he's out there to do.
Right.
That's another issue. Well, I mean, that takes a while to learn, right? The balance between, for playmakers, between looking for their own offense and setting people up and getting a knack for making someone else better, that's something that takes a long time to learn. And he's being, you know, his position's changed, his role has changed multiple times. He's clearly finding success for himself this season very well off the bat. But that could be a long process, you know? And I think, you know, for Jabari Parker, that's like a mental test, right?
Yeah. Well,
how long could this take? How much patience do you have?
And I feel like if you're the Bucks, you gotta see what you have with those two together. And it doesn't, I mean, because this is almost like a transition year anyways. Like, they're not going to contend with the top half of the East. So why not just like run those guys in pick and rolls or just see what you can do with the two of them working together? And instead, they're in that mode where they're like trading off possessions, which I don't know if that's like the greatest long-term thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't watched a ton of them. I'll get back to you once I see a little bit more of their games.
Fair enough.
I think questioning their ceiling at this point with this roster is fair, but thinking that they have a shot at a playoff seat at this point in the East, I think given the way that the first, you know, 10 days has gone out, like they're still in the mix, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, they're pretty surprised. I was surprised by how good they looked, because I also watched a little bit of the Kings game too, where they just dominated. My other note is JJ Barea is going to be hitting bullshit shots for the Mavericks for the rest of my life.
Yeah, or he could be out of the NBA next year. We'll see.
I don't know, man. Every year I say that about JJ Barea, and he's still there running the pick and roll with Carlisle. It's just ridiculous.
So talk to me about the Mavericks, because that was the high moment of their season, needing overtime to score 86 points. Are we ready to kind of write them off? Like,
yes.
Are they done? Are they the Wizards of the West?
I'm definitely ready to write off the Mavericks. I'm just baffled that Barea, you know who he's like? Have you seen Game of Thrones?
Sort of. I mean, there's a lot of bearded guys. They all kind of run together.
Well, no, I'm thinking of the woman who is like, what's her name? Who's like 400 years old and still looks like she's like 30 or whatever. Melisandre. That's J.J. Barea. I think one day we're going to look up and be like, wow, J.J. Barea is 55 years old, and he's been playing with Rick Carlisle for the past 20 years and still doing his thing. So that was my only Mavs thought, is that this dude is never going to disappear.
That's a really grim outlook.
No, not ideal.
Well, are they in the mix now for being the worst team in the West, though? I mean, like, should we put them into that conversation? Like, are they going to, like, either intentionally or not, are they going to basically be a top three type pick this year?
Yeah, I think Dirk hasn't been playing. And if he's not playing, they're definitely in the mix for the worst team in the West. Because I like what the Suns have more than what the Mavs have. Like, the Suns are going to be able to steal some games some nights just because Booker and TJ Warren go off. The Lakers are better. The Kings, as much fun as we have watching them and making fun of them, they're better. So it would take Dirk coming back and getting to a level that I don't think he's going to be at. And ultimately, like, that, it's for the best that they've needed to have a top five pick for the last, like, 3 years to just sort of restart things.
For sure. I think the three teams I'm most worried about in the West right now, Pelicans, obviously.
Oh, boy, Pelicans actually might be in the mix with the Mavs there.
They had some real heartbreakers over the last couple of days, which we will not go into because we don't need to, you know, have any Pelicans fans hyperventilating. But we got, I'd say New Orleans, Dallas, and Memphis are the three that I think I'm the most worried about in terms of, like, can they get it together and or keep it together, you know, over the course of the full season?
Yeah.
I think those three could wind up being the three worst teams in the West. Even though the Lakers, you know, really probably should start tanking at some point to make sure they keep their pick. But you know, the Blazers actually had one season where they could have tanked to keep their pick and didn't. And there was a big debate among the fan base. Hey, should they do this? Should they not? They lost the pick and it wound up working out great for them. They just kind of carried the positive momentum and went forward with it. I could see a similar thing happening with the Lakers this year where everybody thought keeping the pick should have been the highest priority. And I was definitely in that group.
Yeah.
But if you can put together 30 wins, you know, go over your over under, get somebody in free agency, and then those guys are a year older next season, I'm not sure, you know, how big is the beat that you skip, you know?
Yeah.
Like, not having one more prospect, is that the worst thing in the world?
I think it's better for the guys they have. My last Mavs note, though, they were advertising, coming out of commercial at one point, they were advertising a game this week, and it's Tuesday night, and the announcer was saying, I know there's a lot going on Tuesday night, but I just really hope everyone out there is dialed into Mavs basketball. And I tweeted about it and was making fun of it. But guess who they play Tuesday night?
The Lakers.
Our Lakers! After like 8 hours of election coverage, I think I really will tune in and watch D'Angelo Russell go to war with J.J. Barea at midnight on Tuesday.
Oh, your tweet and the announcer was talking about the election? I thought they were talking about my birthday.
Is your birthday tomorrow?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Thanks. That's a lot. I guess my present isn't in the mail, huh?
I guess not. Happy birthday, man. This is great.
Yeah.
You'll celebrate with all kinds of election coverage.
And the Lakers. And the baby Lakers, which is the way all birthdays in LA should be celebrated at this point.
Yeah, it's the dream. All right. Well, yo, let's check in with you on Friday. I'm going to the Cavs White House celebration. I'm waiting to hear back, but we'll have a lot to talk about on Friday. And until then, you know, enjoy it out there, man. Enjoy the Lakers tomorrow
night. Until then, everybody check out the Blake Griffin highlights from the Spurs win, too, because he was putting in work, and the Clippers continue to be flying under that radar looking pretty good.
Yeah.
But I'll talk to you later this week.
All right, man. I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.